Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The 2025 legislative session is underway, and it doesn't seem there's going to be just one big idea that will define the next 45 days. Legislative leaders have talked about affordability, which could mean taxes and housing. There are bills dealing with immigration and refocusing higher education and limiting public unions. Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune said there is one issue that stands out for him this year. It's energy.
Obviously, every legislative session has a lot of major issues. This year, we've got immigration, we've got housing. But the big issue that I see emerging this session is energy. It's an issue that Governor Cox has talked about. And it's an issue that Senator Stuart Adams used at the beginning of the session in his opening day speech.
We need to be positioned as the nation's nuclear hub, not only in power production, but also in the key of supply chain, including mining, manufacturing, and workforce development.
He really highlighted his desire to build nuclear reactors in Utah for the first time.
Inside and outside of Utah, by Utahns.
The reason that Senator Adams is so adamant that we need this energy is there's this emerging artificial intelligence. The demand for that is so overwhelming, more than anybody ever really expected. So the demand for energy is not just so Utahns can flip the light on and watch TV and have their electric vehicles. Senator Adams is couching this as we need to be leaders in the artificial intelligence movement.
The global arms race for AI technology is already underway. Other nations, other countries are not waiting. The race has begun. The nation that masters AI technology will hold and control the keys to global economic prosperity, military strength, and the power to preserve peace.
He's couching this as a national security issue where Utah is leading the way in helping the United States compete on a global scale in meeting these artificial intelligence needs. He wants to have nuclear reactors chained up around the state that can power these huge data centers.
Data centers need what? They need power. They need continuous baseload power. And there's very little, if any, excess power.
So the thing that Utah politicians have always pointed to is the Utah way. It made Utah unique. It made it exceptional. This year, Senator Adams in particular is couching this new term, the Utah dream. And it goes beyond just this energy piece. But the energy piece is important because the energy piece fuels the AI piece. There's talk now of building a spaceport. They're regulating air taxis. It's sort of the Jetson session in some ways. And they kind of are very much looking to what Utah can be 10, 20 years down the road. Senator Mike McKell said in 2034, Utah is going to be hosting the Olympics. We'd be foolish if we didn't take the opportunity to put the best foot out there and sort of lean into the future.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to sketch out what could happen in the legislative session this year. We'll talk about some of the major issues lawmakers are discussing. We'll also talk about some of the political relationships and the important players in the process. We'll have with us for the hour Robert Gerke, along with KUER political reporters Sage Miller and Sean Higgins. We started with the surprising sense of calm at the beginning of the session. Here's Sean Higgins.
Compared to the last couple of years, it's been eerily quiet. 2023 and 2024, we all felt like the person who opened up the closet that had just been accumulating things over the year, and then it all comes avalanching down on top of us. Whereas this year, that closet got opened and things stayed in place for the most part, at least in that first week. So it was a bit of a different dynamic. Didn't feel like we were drinking from a fire hose quite as much as we did in the last couple of years. But the wheels are moving on that bill passing train right now. We've got some bills in the works right now that are looking to make their way to the governor's desk. If not this week, maybe next week. So we'll see where things go.
What about the rest of you? What's the vibe? You apprehension, I think, Robert Herke, you said.
I mean, I was there was this long list of things that they were going to try to get to, you know, and every, as Sean mentioned, the last couple of years have just been this torrent right out of the gate. And I was talking to the speaker just this week, and he said, you know, yeah, this is kind of different. There's not these big issues that suck all the oxygen out of the room right at the beginning of the session. And some of these issues they're working on are also very complex. I mean, we were talking about immigration. You know, there's a whole package of bills that are moving on that. Energy is a very complicated issue. There's a bunch of bills on it. So it's not like there's just sort of like one or two bills that are just these overwhelming, suck all the oxygen out kind of issues. And so it's been a little bit more of a easing into the bathtub, I think.
How I described it was kind of a slow burn until day three, which I think is a breath of fresh air compared to the last 4 years. But I don't think there's any of these big neon signs being like, be angry at this, scream at this, that we've seen in the past few years. I mean, there are two bills, right, that passed out of committee last week. I think probably the two most controversial ones. It has been mellow, and I feel like they're being kind of coy, though. Mm. There is going to be some more bills that are going to be controversial, or the ones that we – I mean, our bills are titled weird, so they don't have these, like, catchy phrases that make you go, oh, like, oh, what's that? You genuinely have to read essentially every single bill to see where the minute details are or where kind of the most scurry is going to happen. And we've seen a few of those, but, like, they're not moving right now. So we're kind
of – That seems unusual.
Yeah, we're all kind of a little bit in limbo.
It is. And part of the reason that they've done it in the past where they bring the big controversial issues out front is because they want to get them out of the way.
Yeah.
That's part of it. But it's also because it gives leadership a lot of leverage over those squishy votes, because if people get squishy on it and vote against those bills that they want passed, they're not going to pass anything the rest of the session. So they have the leverage over those squishy members at the beginning of the session. But I think this session, those issues haven't been at the forefront, and so they haven't needed to exercise that. I mean, maybe the union busting bill that just passed yesterday, maybe the transgender dorm bill that is going to, as Sage mentioned, possibly be up today or tomorrow. But outside of that, it's not those big, you know, weighty, controversial issues.
Do you think it has something to do – the pace, at least so far, has something to do with the fact that Republicans are now in charge of the federal government? And so lawmakers feel a less of a sense of urgency or a need to push back against, like, regulation and those kinds of things.
I would say – that is certainly the feeling that I get. I certainly felt during the Biden administration there was a feeling amongst the Republican supermajority that they really needed to batten down the hatches and show their constituents that they are fighting the big bad federal government. So we saw those big red meat issues come up that the hardcore Republicans really care about, whereas now they don't need to show – obviously, we're in Utah.
Yeah.
There's always the big bad federal government, but they're slightly less bad now, I guess.
Wind is at our back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. I mean, if you looked at the issues that were going to be debated this session, yes, immigration was going to be an issue. Mm-hmm. Public lands, maybe. Maybe there's, you know, going to be some stuff on DEI. But now it's not just sort of pushing back against the federal government. They have this whole field to run on. And so those issues, they're kind of scrambling to play catch up a little bit, I think, not expecting perhaps the Trump victory. Now they've been let off the leash, and whatever they want to do, they have pretty much free rein.
I think they're focusing a kind of a lot on more of these state issues and not so much response from the federal government or kind of just trying to show the government up. I would say when we're looking at election reform, and I think maybe perhaps that is in lockstep with some stuff that has happened on the federal level, but I think that they're going to try and do some big sweeping changes to how Utah runs elections this year. Again, we haven't seen those bills. And like Gerke said, they're very complex. And so I think it takes them a little bit longer to try and iron out those details, unlike some of the other bills that they passed in previous sessions, like banning gender-affirming care for transgender minors. I think that to them perhaps is a little bit less complex than overriding an entire election system or trying to make huge sweeping changes to the way that we run ballot initiatives because they're still upset about the Supreme Court decision.
We'll get to that.
So, and I think those along those two, it's a little bit more friction among the caucus of how they conduct those. So it's not just you're Carrie-Anne Lisenby is working harder to whip some votes. I think that her
we'll
job,
get to her as well. Yes, yes, yes.
So I think she's having to work a little bit harder on these big sweeping statewide changes that everybody's not on board with.
How are lawmakers thinking about Governor Cox right now? The governor doesn't seem to be pushing back on very many of these conservative measures, at least as far as I can tell. You guys can tell me if that's right. Is he sort of ceding the moderate position? How do you have a sense of – there's always a little bit of tension, but is it too early to say?
I think it's a little bit too early to say. Cox is in an interesting place right now, self-imposed. He's essentially made himself a lame duck governor because he's not going to run for a third term. He said it so many times. He said, if I decide otherwise, hold me to the fire on that.
Yeah.
What his next play is anyone's guess. But as far as what that means for his relationship with the legislature, I don't think we'll quite see the Governor Cox who is willing to push back and veto bills that we saw in his first maybe 1 or 2 years in the legislature. I'm thinking of the transgender sports veto that was overturned by the legislature.
But why? Wouldn't he be more inclined to push back because he's lame duck? Or, as you're suggesting, maybe he has ambitions beyond the governor's role that makes him feel like he needs to stay beholden to.
I think whether or not he pushes back will give us an indication of where he's leaning
For
2028.
For what it's worth, I don't think that when Cox is done being a governor, he's going to go be a lawyer again. So
he might not go back to the farm.
I mean, I did ask him last month at the governor's news conference if he was going to serve out this term, and he said that's the plan. He's not had any discussions with anybody about leaving early. So, obviously everything can change. I don't get the impression that those offers have been made for a job in the administration right now. But, you know, we've seen it happen before with Mike Leavitt and John Huntsman, so it wouldn't be unprecedented. I think what he maybe is doing is trying to find the areas where they can work together. Immigration, for example, he's tried to focus that issue on criminal migrants, says that we're not going to just deport people for being here illegally. That's not our top priority. And therein, he kind of avoids the thornier issues, right? You know, you're not going to be breaking up families by deporting a father and leaving mother and kids behind, that sort of thing. So if he focuses on the criminal migrant issue, yeah, there's broad support for that. If he focuses on nuclear power, that's one of his big issues that he's talked about. If he focuses on housing, which is an issue that everybody cares about, he can find common areas of common ground with the legislature. But there will be friction points later on, especially as we get into issues about what they want to do with judges, for example.
Yeah.
He's indicated he would push back against some of the ideas they're talking about there.
Like electing judges.
He said electing judges is a non-starter for him, although frankly, because that would require a constitutional amendment, the governor's kind of cut out of that process. But there will be issues like that where he's going to have to draw a line in the sand. And I think if you look at the way Governor Cox has operated in the past, he's always kind of found a couple issues where he can draw that line in the sand just because there's been this legislative creep that we've talked about on this program before into the executive powers. And you almost have to kind of push back at some point or else you're just going to keep getting rolled over.
All right. Before we get to some particulars, let me sort of ask you about an overwhelming maybe theme, I could put it that way, and that is the influence or the role of this new Trump administration that it might be having on lawmakers. How do you think the new administration is going to affect the session? And I'm interested in, first of all, let's talk about tone before we get to the actual particulars. Is there a different tone now that Donald Trump is president?
I think right off the bat, the opening speeches were considerably less adversarial when we were talking about Washington, D.C. I mean, Schultz still had a hit against the federal government over
this is the speaker,
management.
Mike Schultz.
Speaker Mike Schultz still took a shot at federal management of some campgrounds in the Flaming Gorge area that he talked about fondly growing up, and now they're in disrepair, according to him. But broadly, it's a lot less us versus them rhetoric as far as Utah needing to take a stand than we've seen in the past.
I will say, though, Speaker Mike Schultz, during media availability during the first week of the session, just kept saying Washington was broken, too. So I still think there is some disdain. I think that they've kind of calmed down. They're a lot more chill, for lack of a better word, when it comes to dealing with the administration. But I also think they're going to try and capitalize it a little bit more. They have these bills kind of pushed through, right, when it comes to energy or it comes to air quality or it comes to building houses where they want to streamline the permitting process. And I think that they are very hopeful that the federal government will be on their side of that, of trying to get rid of the red tape so we can build more or drill more or whatever they feel like it. So I've heard some kind of we're hoping, you know, we're crossing our fingers, we're praying to God that Donald Trump will streamline these permitting processes so we can make the Utah dream a reality.
You know, in Governor Cox's State of the State and also in his inaugural speech, his theme was "We build" or something like that. It's this abundance agenda that he's gone to. A lot of it is, you know, we're going to remove regulations on nuclear permitting, things like that, and we're going to have this energy explosion. Hopefully, it's not a nuclear explosion, we're going to have this rebirth. You know, it almost feels like they feel like the boot's off their neck and they can start doing what they wanted to do in the first place. And you know, Utah's got this unleashed potential now, and we'll see how that pans out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that part remains to be seen. But instead of, as Sean referenced, instead of like trying to fight back against the mean, oppressive federal government, they feel like they've kind of been, left to their own devices now. And that's leading to all of this, like, sort of, you know, optimistic kind of, you know, future looking ideas that they're floating in a lot of respects.
Robert Gerke, he's a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We also have with us Sage Miller and Sean Higgins. They're political reporters for KUER and co-hosts of the podcast State Street. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the 2025 legislative session, which is now underway. Legislative leaders have a few key areas they're wanting to focus on: housing, immigration, and affordability, which means tax cuts and housing. They're also talking about nuclear power and reforming higher education. We've also been asking if Utah's mostly conservative lawmakers will be emboldened by a new Trump administration. We have with us Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune and Sage Miller and Sean Higgins of KUER. Let's talk about public land, maybe in the environment, before we get to energy. Energy is a sort of a section in of itself, but the federal government certainly is more in line with Utah lawmakers' ideas for public land. Will we see something in the legislative session that indicates that? And we should point out, just remind listeners, the Supreme Court has, you know, rejected hearing the state's lawsuit over the ownership of public land. So I'm not sure what that's going to mean, but any sense of any of that so far?
As far as it pertains to Utah's lawsuit to take control of 18.5 million acres, I think that issue specifically is largely in Attorney General Derek Brown's hands right now. We haven't seen a refiling of that lawsuit in a lower court yet, but I would think they would maybe try and figure out a solution with the administration first before going to a lower court. The public land issue in Utah is very interesting because there's the documents that created the state of Utah in the 1800s. We have the state constitution and then the act of Congress that made it a state. Both of those documents are very clear that the state of Utah cannot own a lot of the land in the state of Utah. Yeah. So there's two documents with over 100 and some odd years of precedent that are the antithesis of what Utah is trying to do. So we'll see where that goes. I think the legislature passed their law last year that gave themselves the authority to just say no to federal regulation in some respects. I don't know if they'll exercise that necessarily this session because there is a more quote-unquote friendly federal government now. The public lands issue is interesting because the state is pretty limited in what it can actually do in this sense. So I think a lot of it may be just some signaling acts, maybe a resolution or two. I'm not really sure.
You mentioned Speaker Schultz saying that some federal lands were in disrepair, Flaming Gorge in particular, which seemed to be making the case for the state to manage them, which you hear, all right, let's do this. Let's let the state clean up the restrooms at Flaming Gorge or whatever it is. they've talked about that for a long time, it seems.
Yeah, a lot of, on the public lands in particular, it's a lot of, you know, shaking the tiny fist, I think. You know, they do anticipate, I think we all anticipate, that the monuments will be reshrunk, I guess, is that a term? You know, because they were created by the Democratic presidents, Clinton and Obama, shrunk by Trump, restored by Biden. They're going to be shrunk again. And, you know, Governor Cox says, and I think a lot of people would agree, that that ping-ponging back and forth is not good for the management of the land. So, you know, we'll see if the state does anything to try to step in and preserve that in whatever role it can once they're resized. There's some focus on some, you know, access to some public roads, RS-2477 roads and so forth. I think they're kind of looking toward this Homes Act that Senator Mike Lee has proposed in the past that would dispose of some federal land that could be used for housing and maybe laying some of the groundwork for the potential that that could happen. But I think by and large, I agree with Sean that there's just not a whole lot that they can do because federal land is federal land and the state can, you know, again, scream and shout and stomp its feet. But at the end of the day, it's not their land and they can't do much.
I think, as Gerke just said, a lot of the action we will see will be in coordination with the federal delegation, whether it's the Senate or representatives in the House to reform the Antiquities Act or things of that nature to get action at the federal level.
Because there's also Representative Celeste Malloy's bill that essentially is like, I don't remember exactly what it's called. I think it's like the Freeze Act, which essentially would strip the president's ability to like restore monuments or make these executive decisions about public land, because I believe it's an overstep of power and authority. So, I mean, I do see kind of, yeah, I agree with both of them. Just the Utah legislature saying, good job, President Trump. Good job, Mike Lee. Good job, Celeste Malloy. Like, we agree with all of this. You have our support. But again, like, I don't think they have much executive action. They can do some signaling. They can pass some resolutions. They can spend millions of dollars on a public ad campaign. But
run a few more billboards on I-15.
Yeah. Right? Like, but at the end of the day, right, like, if the Supreme Court or any other lower court doesn't take up this case, then, I don't know, try again, regroup. Good luck.
Yeah. Okay, so it was there in the inaugural address of President Trump, drill, baby, drill. What does that mean? What are lawmakers hearing when they say that? Let's talk about energy.
Yeah, they're hoping that there will be more permitting. We should be clear that there was – the United States produced more oil and gas in the Biden administration than any time in history. And so it's not like there's a shortage of oil and gas, but they feel like this is an opportunity to open it up. Spencer Cox has this Operation Gigawatt that he wants to do, doubling the energy production, I believe, in 10 years.
10 years, yeah.
And so
– So wait, and the Senate president wants to triple it by 2050.
Yeah. So they're all kind of setting these lofty targets. It's interesting to note that over the last several years that fossil fuel production in the state has been declining. Renewable energy has been increasing. But this focus seems largely on oil, gas, coal, and now nuclear. That's the big addition to the toolbox that Governor Cox wants. We've always had this weird history with nuclear power here in Utah because of the open air nuclear testing and the downwinders, the people who were sickened or died because of that, and then the attempts to store high level nuclear waste in Skull Valley, even like with the MX missile. There's this consternation about nuclear power in the state. So there's never been an actual concerted push to go in that direction until now. But Governor Cox thinks with the new Trump administration in power, Senate President Stuart Adams talks about micro reactors or small modular reactors like they're trying to do up in Kemmerer, Wyoming. A chain of those that can power AI data centers. And so, you know, this is sort of, again, going back to what Governor Cox was saying about now we build, this is sort of what he's talking about.
Sean, you've been covering this, the sort of effort to create a framework for nuclear energy. I guess it was yesterday they passed a bill to create just that framework. So they're on their way.
Yeah. I was in that committee in the House yesterday, and it was a really interesting discussion. First of all, it passed unanimously out of committee. So Democrats were on board with creating at least the legal and regulatory framework of eventually having nuclear power come to the state of Utah. Like Robert said, nuclear has a lot of baggage, not just in Utah, but across the West and broadly in the United States. A lot of people remember Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. Fukushima was it 2011 when that happened? And when you look at the history of nuclear power in the United States, we essentially took a whole generation of developing this technology off I believe the last nuclear power plant to be built in the U.S. was over 30 years ago. So we've not developed this technology for 30 years. So to get it online, to get it going is incredibly expensive. That Kemmerer plant that Robert mentioned in Wyoming, bankrolled by Bill Gates.
$4 billion.
$4 billion plus dollars, yeah, just to get a proof of concept project off the ground. So, and listening to Representative Carl Albrecht, who is the person who is running this regulatory structure bill, he admits that this is a work in progress and we're 10 plus years from this actually becoming a reality here in Utah.
I will say on the energy front of it being really expensive.
Let's talk about immigration. As far as conservative red states go, Utah's always been seen as kind of an outlier on immigration, at least in the past. Is that over?
I think they've gotten a little bit more aggressive, but I think that they've also made a very strong line of when it comes to immigration and the people who are here without legal status, we essentially want to just deport the ones that have done some kind of criminal activity. It's not like a sweeping everybody who's a migrant without legal status needs to go. So I think they're –
So Utah is still kind of different.
But I don't think that they're embracing immigration and migration as much as they have in the past. I think that this idea of being a sanctuary state pushed on by a lot of hard GOPers has kind of put them a bad taste in their mouth. But we do have like a lot of bills surrounding specifically, they're coining it public safety, and there's other bills trickled in that specifically target what they call non-citizens.
I guess we should explain for listeners an important bit of context here. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has always been this kind of moderating force when it comes to immigration. I guess I'm wondering, has the LDS Church said anything yet on the Hill about this? Because we'd need to talk about this package of immigration bills that seem to be making their way. So, Robert, what do you know about that?
They haven't said anything publicly. You know, it's standard for legislative leadership to have a meeting with some of the general authorities before the session starts. And I honestly don't know if they did that this year or not. They haven't talked about it if they did. But you're right. I mean, in the past, the LDS Church, you know, has particularly when it comes to maintaining the cohesive family structure has been very outspoken and was part of that Utah Compact that, you know, was, again, very unusual at the time when it came into fruition because, you know, there was this big push nationally, a lot of states, Arizona we saw in particular, Texas, people patrolling the border and things like that, you know, and the Utah, instead of going that sort of hard right path, you know, we had driving privilege cards, we had in-state tuition for undocumented children, things like that, that were very much against the grain. Now some of those things are they're looking at taking away. I agree with Sage to a point because they do want to focus primarily on the criminal element. Governor Cox has said that as well. They also want to focus on, when I talked to Governor Cox at the beginning of the session, he said he wants to focus on not providing incentives for people to come here. And one of those incentives is that they're concerned about is health insurance. Dale Walter has a bill this session. Just 2 years ago, the legislature overwhelmingly passed a bill that would extend Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, to the children of undocumented individuals. And now they're trying to repeal that because they don't want to, you know, make that an incentive for people to come. They were seeing, I think that's kind of the direction they're going. Obviously, they want to raise the sentences for people. There's an enhancement. If you're an undocumented person, you commit a crime, it can be bumped up from, say, a Class B to a Class A, which makes your sentence a lot longer and makes you eligible for deportation a lot quicker, that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's sort of a, you know, the pendulum is swinging back, I guess we could say. And I think Utah's falling in line a lot more with the other red states than we have in the past. That Utah, you know, uniqueness or, you know, the Utah way is kind of falling by the wayside a little bit because we're falling in line with what the other states are doing.
And now it's the Utah dream instead of the Utah way.
What is the Utah dream?
Oh, Sean, you want to take that one?
It was one of the themes that seems to be emerging.
Take the American dream we all know and love, crank it up to 11, add nuclear power, and that's our Utah dream, baby.
Yeah, and a home you can afford.
And a home you can afford. Well, that was part of the American dream, too.
Well, maybe we should transition to housing then. There you go. That's a good segue. The governor had set this target of, what was it, 35,000 starter homes within the next 5 years. Doesn't seem to be working very well. What is going on and what's going to be going on in the legislative session regarding housing?
I'm hearing we haven't seen so much bill language yet. I'm hearing it'll be a lot of tweaks this year as compared to broad changes. And a little bit like public lands, housing is kind of out of the state's control in some ways because the authority to actually build things is in the hands of city councils, planning commissions, and county councils throughout the state. So there's only so much the state can do. It can really offer carrots and sticks for getting housing built. Governor Cox has talked particularly about making it easier for developers to build condos instead of apartment buildings. So people could buy their condominium instead of just renting an apartment. I've heard that there's some insurance issues with that. And then some movement on making ADUs, accessory dwelling units, a little bit easier to build. Salt Lake City passed some sweeping zoning changes. I believe it was last year that specifically addressed ADUs. Maybe some of that trickling up to the legislature and making it a little bit more statewide. So some of those changes. But as far as building those 35,000 starter homes, a lot of it is just incentivizing that construction.
I have two thoughts on this. The first one is, the past few years on the housing crisis, Utah has really tried to incentivize. And while that seems to be working some, a really, really massive hurdle is zoning, right? Like, you can't have certain houses somewhere. You can't build certain density. You can't have certain building sizes. Like, all these things are up to the municipalities. And they've done a lot to try and urge them, like, hey, please loosen up a little bit. Like, we don't need NIMBYism from each corner of the state. Can we please just build some housing? And something that we've seen from the legislature in the past is them essentially stripping away some power from the local municipalities. We've seen this happen in Salt Lake City, in Salt Lake County multiple times to say, you need to follow what the legislature says. And I kind of want to see if they're finally to that point on housing and when it comes to zoning, when they say, you need to listen to the legislature now. Baby, we got to build. Okay? So please, we're just going to get rid of some of the red tape that municipalities have placed and say, we're going to try and unify this. That's one thing that I'm kind of looking at. And it seems like Representative Jim Dunnigan's bill in the House. And it sounds like the Republican Jim Dunnigan in the House, he has a bill that's very big that I think is going to try to chip away at that a little bit. The second thing is, though, I think a lot of the conversation, we forget that 30% of Utahns are renters. And year after year, we have nothing addressing their rights, their stability, their ability to maintain and even try and save in order to get a home. And this is yet another year where we have some bills like, let's give some notice to renters when their rent is going to increase. So if they can't afford it, they got enough time to move. That's back again.
Will it pass?
Probably not. it's being run by a Democrat. And in the past, even Republicans have tried to run this bill and it's failed. And so I just think that year after year, there continues to be a lack of appetite for renters, despite it making up a good portion of the Utah population.
I think it's interesting. I wanted to ask about this bill that would keep corporations from buying up housing.
That's a big one. Tyler Clancy.
Yeah, Tyler Clancy. Tyler Clancy and Galen.
He's an interesting figure. We should talk about it in a minute.
We should talk about him. Yeah, he and Galen Bennion both have sort of separate bills that would do the same thing, essentially. And that is that, you know, we've seen it in other markets. It's not been quite as much of an issue here. But where these institutional investors, big corporations, come in and buy up the housing stock, and then they rent it, right? Which is great for them, because if people can't afford to buy a home, as Sage mentions, they're going to rent, and you can charge whatever the heck you want. And we have, again, as she references, extremely pro-landlord laws in this state. So it's a great business to get in. And we're seeing more of it happening. I've heard rumblings about new startups that are going to start eating these homes up. And so they're trying to get out in front of that a little bit. In Salt Lake City, it's about 2.5% of the numbers that we've seen that are owned by institutional investors. But you go to someplace like Atlanta, it's over a quarter of the entire housing stock is owned by these corporations. And so they kind of want to make sure they get out in front of that before, because that just makes home ownership that much more difficult. But kind of going to what both Sean and Sage were saying, this is such a complicated issue, because you have not just the zoning issue, issues, not just the demand issues, but you've also got things like labor costs and what's going to happen to labor costs if the immigrant population suddenly evaporates overnight, right? What's going to happen with the cost of supplies? You know, I mean, those have been sky high. And then financing has been really difficult over the last several years. And so in 2024, we only saw 22,000 units start over in total. That's not just starter homes. That's just all units, apartments, condos, single-family homes.
So you're way off track.
It was the lowest level we've seen since 2016, even after the state's done all this stuff to try to, you know, stimulate it. So most of this issue is out of the state's control. They can try to, you know, put their thumb on the scale a little bit, give it a nudge here and there, but you're trying to, you know, you're trying to move the Titanic with a tennis racket, and it's really, really difficult to do. So a lot of it is going to be out of their hands, but the governor says that the bills that they passed in the 2024 and 2023 session are just starting to take effect. They're starting to see the impacts of those. But if they want to have a meaningful impact on this, there's going to have to be a lot more money brought to bear and a lot more significant change.
I think if any listeners want to have a better understanding of how complicated and frustrating the housing discussion can be, I would encourage them to tune into their next local planning commission meeting when they're discussing a housing development, and all of this will make a lot more sense.
Yeah.
I will say, I think,
by meaning nothing will make sense.
By meaning nothing will make sense.
Yes.
I will say this, we've dubbed it the BlackRock bill, right? This is the one where it's saying like, hey, institutions, please don't buy these homes. And I think this one's kind of interesting. It's sponsored by a Republican representative, Tyler Clancy, who is the youngest member of the legislature. He serves in Provo and he's also a renter. So he kind of, I think he's an anomaly in the big sea of legislators up on the Hill. But yeah, this one is.
Why? Because he has these more, well, let me mention, Clancy introduced this bill in the session that would cut emissions along the Wasatch Front by some 50% in 8 years. That seems kind of progressive for a Republican lawmaker from Utah County.
Yeah, he has some interesting takes on these bills, right? There's another one that's looking at locomotives and trying to drastically decrease the amount of pollution they emit, which we know is a massive deal on the west side of Salt Lake County, where we have these rail yards. And he also talked to me previously before the session that he wanted to deal with some renter issues because the majority of his constituents in Provo are renters, including himself. And so I think that he really is. He's also a police officer. So he kind of has a bunch of different intersects. One of the only Republicans that voted against the union bill as well. I think he's going to be climbing the ranks a little bit. It seems like a lot of people within the legislature very much so respect Clancy.
That's Sage Miller. She's a political reporter at KUER. So is Sean Higgins. They're co-hosts of the podcast State Street. And Robert Gerke is a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation about the 2025 legislative session that got underway last week. We have with us Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, along with KUER's Sage Miller and Sean Higgins. While we're on the subject of particular players in the legislature, can I mention another one at Carrie-Anne Lisenby? Clearfield Republican, not progressive in any way. She's the majority whip in the House, really active on the policy front on a lot of these, I guess, culture war issues, you could say. What is the role that she's playing? And that might give us an entree into just what you're seeing in terms of the culture war stuff that always seems to be there at a legislative session.
Well, listeners will know her as really the standard bearer of the abortion fight in the legislature. Her, alongside Senator Dan McKay, have been the two sponsors of virtually every abortion bill, save for maybe one or two in recent legislative history here in Utah. This year, she's been the standard bearer of these more culture war issues. There's a bill that would be a sweeping expansion of gun rights here in Utah. Carrie Ann Lazenby is the sponsor of that.
I think she has another bill that would prohibit where juvenile transgender minors could live inside of a detention center. It also attached to that says that the state will not provide any gender-affirming care for transgender inmates in incarceration. So that's another, you know, taking up another trans issue. And this is an expansion of the same bill that she sponsored last year. So she really has. And then she's also on some public safety bills as well. I will say it looks like Carrie Ann Lazenby might be one of the busiest people up on Capitol Hill.
Is she going to get this legislation passed?
Yeah.
She probably will get most of it passed, because the thing that makes Carrie Ann Lazenby so powerful is that she has coalesced this group of conservatives, and it's a group of and we're talking of sort of Trump mold conservatives, and it's a group that has been growing over the last several years, and you know, the whispers that I was hearing up at the Capitol was that she was making noise that she wanted to run for speaker last year and the year before, and so she's got sort of that following that you need to keep her on your good side if you're in the House leadership, and obviously being the whip, she's got some, you know, she's at the table in the room where the decisions are made already. So she's got a legion of followers who support her, and I think that gives her a very large platform for her to, you know, lead out on some of these issues that Sage and Sean were talking about.
So let me shift to an issue that it seems like lawmakers are determined not to let go, and that is ballot initiatives and the control that they might have over these ballot initiatives. Sage, maybe give us a little bit of context on all of this. I think listeners may remember some of this, but there's been a bit of kerfuffle.
Yeah, there's been a lot of drama around ballot initiatives, and it's kind of stemming from this Utah Supreme Court decision that says that the Utah legislature overstepped its authority when it completely gutted a voter-approved initiative around redistricting where voters asked and agreed to have an independent redistricting committee in order to help not make the congressional districts gerrymandered or very much so favored for one political party here that would be Republican. And they were very displeased with that ruling, and they called a special session to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot that would essentially give the legislature sweeping power to
Amendment D
to avoid it, to void any ballot initiative that they didn't like. They could essentially gut and say, we're not doing it. That went through the courts, and the Supreme Court was like, no, you can't put this amendment on the ballot. And they were like, grr. So now we are back at the legislative session dealing with ballot initiatives to, as opponents would say, make it harder to have a ballot initiative on the ballot in a state that already makes it very hard to do so. So they're just making it harder. As for Amendment D, will that be revived? Maybe in 2 years. They can't pass a constitutional amendment about it this session. So I think we'll get to see some tweaks, and we've already started to see some tweaks. Robert has had some pretty great reporting out of it. But the thing that I'm looking at is SJR2, which would be a constitutional change that they're proposing to increase.
Tell people what SJR means.
It's the Senate Joint Resolution.
Right.
Yeah. It's way easier to say SJR2. But that essentially would increase the threshold needed for a ballot initiative to be approved from 50% to 60%. So you'd need 60% majority to approve a ballot initiative instead of 50%.
As long as there's only money.
Those that raise taxes.
Raise taxes,
so,
right, yeah.
So, but if you think about it, in 2018, there were three ballot initiatives that passed. There was Medicaid expansion, medical marijuana, and the anti-gerrymandering initiative.
And lawmakers didn't like any of them.
They didn't like any of them, but both the Medicaid expansion and the medical marijuana had a tax increase attached to them, and neither of them got close to 60%. So it makes that threshold for those pretty difficult. The other bill that just passed the Senate this week would require proponents of initiative to spend about $1.4 million publishing the text of their initiative in newspapers across the state. And the reason the legislature is doing that is because part of the reason Amendment D got struck from the ballot last year was because that they didn't meet the constitutional requirement to publish the text of a constitutional amendment in newspapers. It's something that I think most people didn't even know was there. It's never been raised before, but they didn't meet that requirement. They're a little bit peevish about that, I think. And it seems a little maybe petty to say, like, okay, well, initiative backers, you've got to spend $1.4 million to do this. But if you think about it, that's sort of like paying a $1.4 million filing fee for these groups that want to run an initiative. They've got to have that money in the bank to run those ads if this thing goes through as it's written. And
it will kill them.
Many
of them will.
All three of those initiatives that were run in 2018 spent a total of $1.6 million. So for the three of them, you're adding another $5.5 million roughly to the cost of running those initiatives. You're almost doubling the cost of it. So it's a huge threshold. None of the Democrats seemed to raise it as an issue during the debate. I'm not sure that they knew it was in there, but it is. And so, you know, that's over in the House now. So we'll see where it goes. But yeah, between the two of those, between the 60% threshold and the $1.4 million in additional expense, the people who have been looking at initiatives or run initiatives in the past say that it would just obliterate it.
Okay. We're running out of time. Let me ask you a couple of ask you to be brief about a couple
Lightning
of things.
Round.
Although this is a big one, though. Higher education. Legislative leaders have talked about cutting something like $60 million from higher education, redirecting it. Robert Gerke, give us a quick sense of what's going on, and I want to hear the rest of you on this.
Yeah, Speaker Schultz is really driving this. His concern is that people are spending too much time in college and not getting degrees that contribute to the economy, and so he wants to sort of reshuffle higher ed to make it so people are getting through faster, less college debt, which I think most people would agree is a good thing, and then getting degrees that are going to benefit the economy.
So it's not an attack on woke universities?
Well, I mean, there's some of that. I mean, because they think that there's too many worthless degrees. You know, I was a poli-sci major, something like that. No, I'm just kidding about that. But they think
Radio West is driving this economy.
they think there are too many degrees that just aren't producing. That you have students graduating with a bunch of debt and they can't get a job because they've got their degree in tap and modern dance. And so they want to kind of reshuffle this a little bit to orient kids toward engineering and, you know, business and things like that. So part of it is that reaction to the woke university thing. You know, it should also probably be noted that the speaker did not attend college. He's a very wealthy man, but he's, you know, I think there are some in the legislature who don't see it as worthwhile anymore. And so I think it's just sort of trying to streamline it and make these shifts. And there are some things that they can do, frankly. I mean, you know, Utah Valley University in particular is a kind of a transient campus. A lot of students go for some semesters and then don't go and drop out, or they graduate after 6 years. The graduation rates at some of these universities are really low. And so you end up with students who leave university, still have the debt, but don't have the degree. And they're trying to figure out ways that they can make it a little bit easier for that. I think there's room for reforms. But we've got to kind of wait and see what shape those take.
I think especially with this higher education bill, I think that is another example of Carrie Ann Lisenby, the majority whip, having to whip a lot of votes because people in her party aren't necessarily on board. John Johnson, Senator John Johnson, who is probably one of the most conservative lawmakers up on the Hill.
Former professor.
Yes. He said, "I'm a little bit concerned with the focus only being on, did this person get a job? I want to know, did this person create a new venture? Did they create something new in the economy? Did they become the next great leader in academia, or did we produce the next generation of thinkers that are going to be involved in the legislative process?" So he's concerned about this, and so are a lot of people up on the Hill. So I think this idea of kind of taking away from maybe like the liberal arts or the humanities, some lawmakers have said, great, they can do math, but can they talk to me? And I think that is a kind of a big concern. So I think this is going to have a lot of tweaks before it gets in front of any kind of legislative body.
One thing that really stood out to me in Speaker Schultz's opening remarks is his focus on non-traditional education, particularly trade schools. He gave an example of high school students in Davis County who were learning technology adjacent skills, but were finding jobs that did not require a college degree. I think anyone who has tried to do any sort of housework or renovations, if you're not a DIY person, you know there is a shortage of people in the trades that are well trained. And there is a huge demand for that in the market right now because over the last few decades, everyone was pushed toward a 4-year college degree that didn't produce the plumbers and the electricians and the carpenters that are needed to, again, build all this housing we need. So all of these issues are interconnected. When you start pulling on these threads, it affects everything else in the system. So I think education is going to be a big focus. I don't think overtly it's an attack on the quote-unquote woke university, but I do think there is some streamlining they're really going to look toward, empowering young people to maybe look the non-traditional route, go to a trade school, I don't know, become a pilot, become an electrician, become a carpenter, become a builder, as opposed to getting that degree that may pay significantly less than if they maybe just got a two-year degree and then went into the trades.
Final quick question, and we'll spend more time with this at another time, but people are going to wonder about what lawmakers might be thinking about in terms of Great Salt Lake and water. Anything to say about that quickly?
There's going to be a moratorium on bills when it comes to sweeping overhauls with water. Speaker Mike Schultz has been very upfront about that. They have made a lot of changes within the last few years during the legislative session, like sweeping overhauls to water law, or like figuring out how to measure water and ag optimization, all of these things. And they said, we need to pause and see if this stuff is working before we intervene further.
Sage Miller, along with Sean Higgins, they're political reporters for KUER. They co-host the podcast State Street. Robert Gerke is a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're also on Instagram at Radio West. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.